Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 6, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Mahasanatha Sutta, the Greater Discourse on Emptiness. This is the second of three talks on emptiness, as the Buddha taught emptiness, to empty oneself of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. There is a related article on my website, and if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So as I said earlier, this is the second of three talks this week on emptiness as the Buddha taught emptiness. One of the reasons why I'm teaching this and teaching all three so close together is to clearly explain what the Buddha meant by emptiness and to point out the differences and the contradictions in the different applications of emptiness in modern Buddhism. The first sutta that I taught on Tuesday, the Kulasanatha Sutta, the Buddha teaches his cousin Ananda emptiness as emptiness relates to self-referential views that cause clinging first to physical objects and then ultimately clinging to conceptual thought constructs that were part of something the Buddha studied. The Buddha studied with two famous teachers back then, Alarakalama and Udeka Ramaputta, who both taught different understandings, but both of them were based on the Vedas, which were the precursor to modern Buddhism. And in those suttas, these ideas of creating a type of mental emptiness or a mental nothingness is very common, and it's taught almost as, or not almost as, it's taught as those are the goals, to attain these types of thought constructs where basically you have no awareness of who you are or what you are in relation to anything, which often felt kind of unproductive to me, but I chased after it anyway until I realized that that wasn't leading me to the goal, which is, interesting enough, exactly what the Buddha understood, that creating these ideas of an emptiness as an environment is really just avoidance from developing a full understanding of who we are in relation to the world. And at the end of that sutta, the Buddha takes Ananda to all these different levels of awareness and then says, that's not emptiness, that's not what we're after. He talks to Ananda about the plane of neither perception nor non-perception, and the plane of nothingness or the plane of emptiness. And after he explains what those planes are, he says, forget about it. Those aren't the goal. That's not what we're after. And he concludes that sutta with basically saying, what you were hoping to empty yourself of is emptiness of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So the Mahasanatha Sutta, which is also given to Ananda, takes emptiness in a slightly different approach. And I'll just read it rather than explain it. That's why I wrote it. The Greater Discourse on Emptiness, the Mahasanatha Sutta. The Buddha was in Kapalavatthu at the Banyan Park. Returning from his alms rounds, he noticed the many resting places prepared at Kalaka Kamaka, the Sakin's dwelling, and wondered if there were many monks living there. So the Buddha is concerned in the close association that these monks are living in and the social aspect that they've developed over their life. And he's also noticed that they're, because of those attachments to the group and the identity that's now created by that group, that their actual Dhamma practice is becoming confusing and diluted. Ananda and many other monks were at the dwelling of Gata making robes. That evening, the Buddha went to Gata's dwelling. He asked Ananda about the many resting places at Kalakamaka's dwelling and if there were many monks living there. Ananda replied, yes, teacher, many monks are in attendance there and we are making robes for all of them. The Buddha was concerned about the social aspects of living as a close community. He remarked to Ananda that a Dhamma practitioner does not flourish if they delight in company and as committed to delighting in company. So what he's talking, he's not saying that you should not be around people and be part of a sangha, But what he's concerned about and what he's teaching Ananda is to start creating an identity and connections and clinging between the different people of the community. In other words, just creating another identity as being one of this group rather than creating your own understanding of the Dhamma. Because when you start falling into this this group mentality, it's usually the direction that the group wants to move in as far as their Dhamma practice in, is that will prevail rather than the actual Dhamma itself. The Buddha continues, a Dhamma practitioner does not flourish if they delight in being part of a group and rejoices in being part of a group. So again, he's emphasizing creating an identity as being part of the group. And it's very interesting that today many, I would say nearly 100% of the modern Buddhist schools, whether it's a traditional lineage that you can trace back thousands of years or a meditation group that sprung up in the last week, the first thing they want to do is to create a name. And then they all want to be part of that. You're creating an identity over this special group rather than keeping your focus on the Buddha's teachings. There's no mention at all of the Buddha ever creating any type of special reference to himself or the sanghas that grew up around himself. In fact, he was very careful not to even call himself the Buddha. He always referred to himself as the Tathagata, which just means that I'm the one that went forth and I figured this out first. That's all. And now I'm teaching you. It is indeed impossible when a Dhamma practitioner delights in company, is committed to company, who delights in being part of a group and rejoices in a group, that they will achieve the pure pleasure of renunciation, of seclusion, of unbinding and release of self-awakening. Ananda, it is indeed possible for one who lives alone, withdrawn from company and withdrawn from groups, that they can achieve the pure pleasure of renunciation, of seclusion, of unbinding and release, and of self-awakening. Ananda, it is impossible for a Dhamma practitioner who delights in company and is committed to delighting in company, who delights in being part of a group and who rejoices in being part of a group, who is able to enter and remain in the release from self-referential views, that his temporary and pleasurable, or in the more refined release from self-referential views, that is not temporary and is beyond fabrication. A lot of words, it again is just pointing back to that self-identification as a group, and making the group identification more important than your actual Dhamma practice.
So could you just read the last line of that? I was following just up into the very end.
I will, but that the last line is actually that entire paragraph. So
No. They just read the last after the last comma.
Who delights in being part of a group and rejoices in being part of a group is able to enter and remain in the release from self-referential views? Let me continue. That is temporary and pleasurable, or in the more refined release from self-referential views that is not temporary and is beyond fabrication. So, I mean, I can see how that's confusing to me, and I wrote it and I read it a million times. But what the Buddha's saying to Ananda is that when you've created an identity as part of a group, it is impossible to end or develop awakening as a Buddha defined awakening, which is release from clinging to all self-referential views.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And if you think about that, when I've created an identity now as part of this group, that's just another layer of self-identification.
Right. That part I get. I just wanted that one word. But
oh,
that's
I'm sorry.
That doesn't happen. Don't worry about it.
Okay. So
we're not part of cross-river meditation here. At all.
I hope not. The Cross River Meditation, that came up Tuesday night too. It simply identifies the place. You know, every place needs a place.
Right.
You know?
Correct. Needs a marker.
Yeah. My commentary in here. In a typical translation of cessation of self-referential views are described as awareness release. That's when the translation from the Pali to the English by Thanissara Bhikkhu is probably the best translator because he keeps it in the right context. He uses that term awareness release as opposed to release from self-referential views. Awareness release just means that you're mindful of abandoning those things that you were previously clinging to. You're mindful of the release. You're aware of the actual process of gaining freedom from clinging to views and clinging to groups. release from self-referential views is translated directly from the Pali as awareness release. The Buddha continues, Ananda, it is indeed possible for one who lives alone, withdrawn from company and withdrawn from groups, to enter and remain in the release from self-referential views, that is temporary and pleasurable, or in the more refined release from self-referential views, that is not temporary and is beyond fabrication. I do not see even a single being who would not experience confusion, delusion, and suffering from being passionate and taking delight in company groups. In other words, again, just to reemphasize, creating an identity as being part of a certain particular group. Delight in this case, this is my commentary again, delight in this case is referring to clinging to a self-identity arising from entanglements with others and forming an identity as one of a particular group, taking an identity from association with a group or accommodated practice. Rather than taking refuge in a well-focused sangha, the Buddha has noticed that those whose entanglement and associations with unfocused groups, unfocused on the Four Noble Truths, that is leading them to further confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. This is similar to the reference of clinging to the village in the Kula Sinada Sutta. In the beginning of that sutta, the Buddha is making reference to clinging to your immediate surroundings as creating an identity to that. Notice in nearly endless modern Buddhist lineages, schools, and smaller groups that establish themselves, furthering eye-making with special names and unique practices, yet still insist that they are Buddhist while contradicting much of what the Buddha teaches. The Buddha continues, Ananda, there is a pleasant abiding discovered by the Tathagata, the Buddha, not attending to any self-referential views, who enters and remains in an internal quality that is empty, this is an important line here because he's teaching the true meaning of emptiness, that is empty of any self-referential views, an internal emptiness. And that speaks directly to what the Buddha is using the term emptiness for. Rather than an environment that we're hoping to attain to or aspire to, emptiness of clinging to self-referential views. Another even shorter way, maybe simpler way of saying that, is emptiness of ignorance, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha continues, while abiding in this pleasant abiding, he is visited by others, his mind well established in seclusion. Now again, this is pointing to the Buddha is not saying you should go live in a cave for your entire life, but you should establish yourself in a singular practice of non-self-identification with others around you. The framework of the Eightfold Path is why the Buddha taught that, so that we can develop that singular understanding that I am not clinging, or I'm not creating an identity or an awareness that is clung to any other external object. While abiding in a pleasant abiding, he is visited by others, his mind well established in seclusion, and having abandoned the fermentations that develop from clinging to company and groups, he converses with others only when necessary and skillful. This is an aspect of right speech and right action. And then they take their leave. So that's another interesting part. You develop the Dhamma, you share the Dhamma with others, you experience it, but then you take your leave. You don't have to continue to create. In fact, he's warning against this, creating a social aspect around your Dhamma practice. Now, also remember, he's speaking to monks who have committed to be part of a local Sangha, too. And they have committed to develop his practice, his Dhamma.
John, haven't before we've spoken about seclusion as a kind of a mental attitude also of non-clinging?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
So you can be within a social context, and I understand the aspects of right speech and furthering eye-making or clinging to identification or idle chatter and all that. But also if one is, let's just say, kind of in a social context, but the mind is a renunciate mind, right? You're letting go of that. You can do what's indicated because it's,
yeah,
indicated and just let it be.
Yes. What is
some level of discernment.
What is important here is, and remember the context, mm-hmm. that the Buddha walked up into a gathering that he recognized that these mm-hmm. practitioners were placing more importance on what their group has developed as a Buddhist practice, placing more importance on social interaction rather than actually practicing the Dhamma. So what he's cautioning Ananda about is don't create a Dhamma practice that is associated with others in that way. Again, he's talking about keeping your Dhamma practice very well focused and pure. And he's warning against the dangers of trying to take that Dhamma practice and create a community over it. Again, something that's very common today. I think I lost my spot. Yeah, that last line, and then they take their leave, too. That's an important thing. Again, the Buddha's not saying that we shouldn't have any contact with the outside world. He's talking about a Dhamma practice and keeping it well focused. And he's recognized and he's telling Ananda the danger of taking your Dhamma practice, this thing that is so pure and undistorted, and creating a social aspect about it, and you're likely to lose everything in that. And it's because of the social pressures. But remember, the Buddha did not live his life in isolation. He was constantly involved with the surrounding community, and he was very deeply involved in the social aspects and the governmental aspects of what was going on in northern India. He didn't just meditate and escape from the world that way, but he carried his well-concentrated mind and his refined mindfulness off his cushion into the world and was able to remain separate from the world. Within his own sangha, he always came back to the importance of, in fact, this is an aspect of the Vinaya rules. The Vinaya is the rules for being part of the monastic community. That when you're gathered as a monastic community, an aspect of that is you only discuss the Dhamma. And you talk about that. You talk about the Dhamma that he taught. You don't get into all kinds of other discussions about maybe the Vedas, which were common at the time, or even political talk. When you're gathered as a sangha, you talk about the Buddha's teachings. Do you have something more?
Well, I was going to say that if this might be, I will refrain from further comments after this. But if something,
you don't have to refrain from further comments.
But I don't want to take the class longer than it needs to be. I used to think that talk, because I could be really rigid sometimes, like talking of the Dhamma, you know, means like you're not allowed to talk about anything else. But sometimes I think perhaps, I don't know, is it like even if you're having a conversation about currently what's occurring or something, but as long as you're seeing it within the context of impermanence and self-referential views, and like you can be discussing something all mindful of that whole context. So
yeah, that's certainly
true. We're
talking about
health, sick, and aging, or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So we're understanding that this is dukkha, this is a curse, so it can be discussed within a wise context.
Yes, and the Buddha touches on that in here. He talks about how to even do that.
Discuss.
And in fact, he uses that in the words that he uses as being friendly with the Dhamma, and being friendly with the teacher. Meaning, if you're going to do that, you need to have the right context in which to have that discussion. If your Dhamma practice is out of context due to your associations, you're not going to be able to keep it well focused. So, if when I get to that point, I think you'll recognize it, and then see if that answers your question or if it relates to what you're talking about. So Ananda, practice to enter and remain in internal self-referential emptiness. Again, referring to the right application of emptiness. Free of clinging, one can develop concentration. When withdrawn from the results of ignorant views, well concentrated, one enters and remains in the first jhana. So, Alan, I know that all of this is really out of context. But remember, like we talked about last night, everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of Four Noble Truths and developing that understanding. So this is too. Now I'm talking about the jhanas. That word is spelled J-H-A-N-A. And there's four jhanas. And all that those are, these have taken kind of mystical connotations too. But the jhanas are different, are merely different levels of meditative absorption that everyone that takes to this practice develops. So I'm just putting that into context for you. The results of ignorant views, well concentrated, one enters and remains in the first jhana. As concentration deepens, one enters the second jhana and the third jhana. Finally, one enters and remains in the fourth jhana, a quality of mind that is pure and calm, with no discrimination between pleasure and pain. This is how one becomes unified within and well concentrated. This Dhamma practitioner is settled in internal self-referential emptiness, Their mind does not crave internal self-referential emptiness anymore. Peace and calm is understood as being empty of clinging views and unconditioned mindfulness. Empty of clinging views and unconditioned mindfulness. Having emptied themselves of self-referential views, they remain mindful of internal and external emptiness. Excuse me. Their mind is beyond disturbance. Another aspect of emptiness. Their mind is beyond disturbance, free from external and internal disturbance. They are brilliant and alert and at peace. It's probably the best description of emptiness.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Free from external or internal disturbance, they are brilliant and alert and at peace. That directly relates to how the Buddha described the quality of an awakened mind. And he used one very simple word to do that. Calm. And isn't that really what we're all after? We'd like to be able to develop a calm mind that lasts, that persists no matter what's occurring around us. That's exactly what the Dhamma develops. The Buddha continues, they take pleasure in the emptiness of self-referential views. Again, a very clear instruction on what we're hoping to develop. They have developed skillful concentration. Whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, this Dhamma practitioner knows that no craving or regret or any unskillful quality will arise. They have that confidence that they've developed the Dhamma correctly. Their speech is not base or vulgar or common or ignoble or harmful or unnecessary or does not lead to disenchantment or to dispassion or to cessation or to calm or direct knowledge. Or finally to unbinding, to rightly self-awakened. They are unconcerned with kings or robbers or food or armies or gossip or talk of existence or non-existence. Again, referring to those planes of consciousness that are taught in other teachings as goals to achieve. Or gossip or talk of existence or non-existence or any talk rooted in self-interest. Remember that the Baccarata Sutta where the Buddha talks about right speech is self-effacing speech. We're not trying to use our speech to continue to promote a doctrine of I. Their mind is alert and well-concentrated. This Dhamma practitioner develops the right intention, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, to engage in right speech, the third factor of the Eightfold Path, that is free of craving and clinging and is scrupulous, supportive of the Dhamma and leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to calm, to direct knowledge, to unbinding, and to self-awakening. Their mind is alert and well-concentrated. This Dhamma practitioner develops the right intention to think skillful thoughts, free of group influence, that lead to renunciation, to harmlessness, to the cessation of confusion, delusion, and stress. Their mind is alert and well concentrated. While dwelling in seclusion, their mind, well concentrated, mindfulness of right intention provides the framework to recognize and abandon thoughts that are base, vulgar, common, ignoble, hurtful, that do not develop disenchantment, dispassion, release, calm, direct knowledge, self-awakening, and unbinding. Alan, do you remember last night when I mentioned briefly what right intention is? Right intention is intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. So again, just to make sure that you're seeing this in the context. They maintain the right intention to think thoughts that are noble and develop renunciation, harmlessness, and liberation. They are well concentrated and empty of any disturbing thoughts. Isn't that wonderful to have that kind of mind, that quality of mind that is empty of any disturbing thoughts? Ananda, develop refined mindfulness of the six sense bases. Six sense bases are five physical senses and that sixth sense of our thinking, consciousness, consciousness with a small c. Ananda, develop refined mindfulness of the six sense base to understand how contact with the senses creates disturbance and inflames passion. Now think about the setting that the Buddha is teaching this in. You're in a group that may be very enthusiastic about use the umbrella term, a spiritual practice. And in their enthusiasm, the group enthusiasm, you can easily get carried away. The Buddha is speaking directly to that because he's noticed it right in front of him in this gathering. How contact with the senses create disturbance and inflames passion. Ask yourself if there is any disturbance formed by engagement and self-identification with regard to contact at the sixth sense base. In other words, when you find yourself getting excited or drawn in, ask yourself, is there any I-making in this? Am I using this situation to create further delusion, confusion, and suffering for myself? And if you are, remove yourself from it. of if upon mindful reflection you find that disturbance has arisen from contact, then you will know that you are not empty of craving and clinging. But if you find that there is no disturbance that arises in your mind from contact at the sixth sense base, then you will know the craving for sensory satisfaction has been abandoned. The quality of your mind will be well concentrated and empty of any disturbing thoughts. My commentary on this. In these two sentences, the Buddha is describing very clearly how to recognize and abandon eye-making through the well-integrated framework of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, the five clinging aggregates should be seen as arising and passing away. Form arises and passes away. Feelings arise and pass away. Perceptions arise and pass away. Fabrications arise and pass away. And deluded thinking arises and passes away. So again, relating it to the five clinging aggregates, again, I know, Alan, this is a little out of context. The five clinging aggregates of form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and the resulting consciousness are taught to describe how a clinging mind creates the appearance of a self that seems permanent. But when you look at each one of these elements that compiles the five aggregates, every one of those is impermanent. And if it's impermanent, you cannot establish a self in that impermanence. And that's what this is referring to. Lost my place. Sorry. They maintain the right intention to think thoughts that are noble and develop renunciation, harmlessness, and liberation. They are well concentrated and empty of disturbing thoughts. Ananda developed mindfulness of the sixth sense base to understand how contact with the senses creates disturbance and inflames passion. Ask yourself if there is any disturbance formed by engagement and self-identification with regard to contact at the sixth sense base. If upon mindful reflection you find that disturbance has arisen from contact, then you will know you are not empty of craving and clinging. But if you find that there is no disturbance that arises in your mind from contact at the sixth sense base, then you will know the craving for sensory satisfaction has been abandoned. The quality of your mind will be well concentrated and empty of disturbing thoughts. I realize I read that twice. Sorry about that. Maintaining refined mindfulness. Any conceit that supports the five clinging aggregates is abandoned, and this one is mindful that they have emptied themselves of any disturbance formed by ignorance. The quality of mind is well concentrated and empty of any disturbing thoughts. Ananda, the qualities that are developed through the Dhamma are singularly useful in developing understanding of reality. They are noble, transcendent, and cannot be affected by ignorance. Developing right intention to recognize and abandon all craving for and clinging to self-referential views develops emptiness of craving and clinging, and emptiness of all self-referential views. The Buddha continues, now, Ananda, what do you think is a proper goal for a disciple, even after a rebuke from the teacher? Ananda says, you are our teacher and your Dhamma is our guide. Please explain this statement for our long-term benefit. More, this kind of gets into what you were, the question you brought up before. Ananda, it is not skillful to follow a teacher simply to hear discourses or dogma. Meaning follow a teacher just because they might have a particular notoriety or be teaching something that you're particularly interested in. They might have a great following. The Buddha's talking to be skillful in your discernment. It is not skillful to follow a teacher simply to hear discourses or dogma. You have done this for a long time and have understood them according to your views. But talk on modesty, contentment, seclusion, non-entanglement, persistence, wisdom, virtue, and concentration, talk that is scrupulous, conducive to refined mindfulness, that develops directly dispassion, disenchantment, cessation, calm, unbinding, and the direct knowledge and wisdom of release, this is skillful to attend to and to hold in mind. In my commentary, mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. Here the Buddha is teaching Ananda that when views are not inclined away from ignorance, they will fail to understand the purpose of the Dhamma. Furthermore, the Buddha is teaching Ananda that the Dhamma must be integrated as the framework for one's life rather than a simple intellectual engagement with the teachings, which is often how modern Buddhism presents the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, almost as an anachronism rather than the only path the Buddha ever taught. This being the case, failure to empty oneself of clinging to ignorant views will lead to the long-term suffering for a teacher, meaning a teacher is teaching something other than Dhamma, or the student, or anyone engaged with that Dharma. How does this occur? For a teacher, even dwelling in seclusion, becomes enamored by offerings of trinkets or praise and falls into the three defilements. It's a good way of, I'll save that commentary. This can only develop further confusion, deluded suffering, deluded thinking and suffering. The three defilements are greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. The Buddha continues, there is also the case of a student lacking understanding, imitates the teacher, and has failed to empty themselves of clinging to ignorant views and becomes enamored with trinkets or praise or falls into the three defilements. What the Buddha is referring to in a great extent is not just physical attachments to trinkets, but also the attraction and the clinging to being a part of this particular teacher's group or a particular group anyway. There's what most of the non-secular, meaning non-religious, Buddhist sanghas all have a very special identification and a very special name. And the people that join those sanghas are encouraged to create an identity as being one of those sanghas, and usually name-changing and taking different names is part of that, but not always. There then is the case where one engaged with a Dhamma fails to empty themselves from clinging views. A Tathagata has arisen in the world, a worthy and rightly self-awakened one. Dwelling in seclusion, he avoids becoming enamored by offerings of trinkets or praise and does not fall into the three defilements. His mind is calm and empty of disturbance. A student of the Tathagata dwelling in seclusion becomes enamored by offerings of trinkets or praise and falls into the three defilements and lives in luxury. This can only develop further confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. It is in this regard, Ananda, that a Dhamma practitioner who fails to empty themselves of the defilements can only continue confusion, deluded thinking, and disappointment. Do not engage with the teacher or the Dhamma in opposition. Engage with the teacher and the Dhamma with friendliness. That alone will be for your long-term well-being and happiness. And how do students engage in opposition to the teacher? A little self-identity there? And how do students engage in opposition with the teacher? When the teacher teaches the Dhamma with understanding, meaning a teacher that teaches with understanding has to have actually studied the Buddha's teaching. How else could you understand it? And how do students engage in opposition to the teacher? When the teacher teaches the Dhamma with understanding, and this is another important part, and concern for the student's well-being, the most compassionate human being I've ever read about or learned about is the Dhamma, and it's because of his incredible care and compassion for the people that came in front of him, his students, and teaching a very well-focused and singular Dhamma. He wasn't concerned about gaining trinkets or praise from his students. He never cared about that. He never cared about setting himself in any special way. And that's what he's talking about here. And how do students engage in opposition with the teacher? I'm sorry for going back and forth, but just trying to keep it in context. When the teacher teaches the Dhamma with understanding and concern for the student's well-being, but the students do not listen or apply themselves to understanding, they stray from the Dhamma. This is how students oppose the teacher. So even during the Buddha's time, there were many, many students that sat and listened to what he had to say and completely disregarded it, which was okay with the Buddha. But what was more egregious to him and more troubling was those that took part of his Dhamma and then tried to create their own Dhamma out of it and then separated themselves from the Sangha and created something else. And there's many accounts in the Pali Canon of students that did that. One that comes to mind is Devadatta, who was a cousin of the Buddha, who took the Dhamma, added things that he wanted to add, most of them were these things from the Vedas, created his own following. In fact, he got about 500 people to follow him in his own type of teaching. And then he conspired to kill the Buddha, to eliminate the competition. And he tried on two occasions and failed on both occasions. But that's how far that can take, that the self-referential views and the need to create your own special type of Dhamma practice, it almost got the Buddha killed. And it destroyed Devadatta's life. He never came back to the Sangha. My commentary. The Buddha here is referring to students that insist that the Buddha should teach a Dharma that fits their own confused views, rather than teach a useful and well-focused Dhamma. This is the theme of many suttas, and the Saddhama Sutta is one example. I just cite that here. I'll actually be teaching the Saddhama Sutta in about 2 weeks. The Buddha continues, and how do students engage with the teacher and the Dhamma in friendliness? When the teacher teaches the Dhamma with understanding and concern for a student's well-being, and the students listen and apply themselves, you hear that? And apply themselves to understanding, they do not stray from the teacher or the Dhamma. This is how students engage with the teacher in friendliness and not in opposition. The Buddha continues. Now think about this. This is 2,600 years ago. The Buddha has spent time with Ananda. Ananda is his cousin, and his cousin has been his attendant for a long, long while. The Buddha's words to his cousin. Ananda, engage with me in the Dhamma and the Dhamma in friendliness. This will be for your long-term well-being and happiness. And he continues, I will not hover over you, but I will simply remind you again and again of the Dhamma. In other words, he's not going to put a heavy thumb onto Ananda. But when it's appropriate, he will remind him again and again. The Buddha is saying, I'm taking this role on as your teacher. I'll be tireless in this. I'll do this again and again. I will remind you again and again of the Dhamma. What is not essential, I won't teach you and we'll be gone. In other words, he's not going to get into any other teaching. He's promising his cousin and the Sangha that's gathered, I won't get into anything that could in any way be a distraction from the Dhamma. I won't teach anything that's not essential. And what is essential, and only what is essential, will remain. And you think about how important that is, and how important the Buddha's commitment was to his own Dhamma, and how his understanding, how conditioned mind will grasp at anything for distraction. He understood how important it was to keep it well focused. I will not teach anything that is not essential. He's making a promise to his cousin and to everyone else gathered. You can trust in me. This is what conclude the sutta. This is what was said, and Ananda was delighted in the Buddha's words. That's how many suttas are concluded. Those gathered were delighted in these words. So that's the end of the sutta. A little bit more commentary. I realize it's a rather long talk tonight, but we're almost done. The next to last sentence of the sutta, I will not hover over you, but I will remind you again and again of the Dhamma. I just love that line. Maybe that's why I wrote it twice. What is not essential will be gone, and what is essential will remain, is significant as it speaks to the misunderstanding that an all-encompassing application of the Dhamma is useful or effective, or that anything of value is lost in renunciation and developing emptiness of clinging. What is abandoned is of no value, and what remains is of singular importance. Those that have listened to me for a while know that one of my focus on my teaching is pointing out what the Buddha taught and what he didn't teach, and this is exactly why. It's not to put down other traditions or any other sanghas or anything else, but it's to remain singularly well focused on what the Buddha taught. It's the most important thing, at least in my opinion.
And repeat it tirelessly, endlessly, until you no longer can repeat it.
That's true. That line in there about the all-encompassing, there's such an intense push to reconcile all the modern Buddhist teachings into one common Western Buddhism. And again, 2,600 years ago, the Buddha was saying, don't do it. He's given us what's essential. Teach and learn only what's essential. I'm skipping a couple paragraphs if you've read this, but just to conclude this. The Buddha consistently described an awakened human being, an arahant, as unbound or released from clinging to any phenomenal object, event, view, or idea. Rather than teaching that all things are interdependent, interconnected, or interbe, the Eightfold Path develops the compassion and wisdom to free all beings from clinging to the world by freeing oneself, including a Dhamma teacher, from clinging. So that's the end of that part two in that talk. So let's just go around the room, and if you have any questions, we have a small group, so you can ask any questions or make any comments or just talk about your meditation practice and start with Stefan. Good to see you this evening, Stefan. What did you think of all that?
Any questions or comments? It was great sutta, and I like how clearly applicable it is to a lot of, you know, modern stuff going on. It's not so hard to imagine how that fits in with groups you might have had contact with or whatever. I think my practice has had a hard time since I went back to work for the farm season. I've cut some of my morning sitting in favor of doing some exercise, and some of the rest of it has been a lot drowsier since I started, you know, getting up early in the mornings. But I don't know, that just seems like the way the seasons go for me. I don't know. That's all, I guess.
Thank you. Those that don't know, Stefan is co-owner of the Tinicum,
Tinicum CSA.
The community supported agriculture, which is just over the bridge, and it's just amazing fruits and vegetables, mostly vegetables, that Stefan and John grow. I still think of those turnips from 2 years ago now. They were just so good. Never tasted anything quite like that. Maura, how are you tonight? It's good to see you tonight.
I'm good. I'm sleepy. I told you that might be rising tonight. I was better to lay down and listen. I could focus better. Sometimes I have a hard time focusing when there's visual, visually distracting. So it was I could really take it in laying down, not worrying about my body, because I'm this body is tired right now. So I thought it was an excellent sutta too. I read the other one, but I didn't read this one. And I just agree with Stefan. I think there's so much that's in there that's you've talked about in the past and is consistent with the Buddhist teachings, and is consistent. I really like the ending, that it's kind of like a handful of leaves, but in that, I've only taught you what's essential, and what's essential will remain. And the Buddha, as has been said many times before in class or here or there in the suttas, there's so much he was aware of, and the wisdom that he had was vast. But he was very disciplined and compassionate in not discussing that.
Yeah.
Because it...
Yeah, out of compassion, you're right. That's the...
Yeah, so... And he could probably have wild conversations, you know, but really was really quite concerned for the release of suffering. And I listened to your talk from last night, and I really, really enjoyed kind of the takeaway and the wrap-up of being able to live in this world, in this life, free of clinging and with a calm and peaceful, bright, alert mind. And being able to sit and not have to go after or push away anything. What's right in front of you is very clear what to do if there's an action or required. It's bothering me because I saw an image this morning, somebody's traveling and in Asia, and it was, I looked at it very briefly, but it was mounds of incense, mounds, and it's like an incense factory maybe in Bhutan or somewhere, right? And the incense is made of alcohol and flowers and anything that the gods would like. And I was like, you know, but I do get that you know, there's still this offering of trinkets, and okay, you can look at it, okay, well, it's a letting go of clinging, but it's a big old distraction, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, like, why did, about, everybody's got to have a living, I guess, I don't know, but who are we offering that to? What's that, you know, anyway, that's all.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. The Buddha recognized the ineffectiveness and the distraction of those types of rites and rituals even back then. The third discourse that the Buddha gave, the fire discourse, speaks to that too. Let go of those types of things. Thank you. Kevin, good to see you tonight. How are you?
See you, good. I actually got a chance to read both of these today, or yesterday and today.
Good.
Since 2 days at work. And this is so much more straightforward than the first one. For me, it was.
Yeah, for everyone.
The first one, it's almost like koans. You can see why they were developed or something. I don't know. There were so many double negatives that were hard for me to follow. And it was really, it was less clear. But this one was much clearer, much more direct, and just much more succinct and focused on the teachings. Mm-hmm. And as you read it and as you read about people who follow this, I mean, it's such a, for me, maybe a distant goal of being able to achieve that. It's so, to have that perfection is so, it's so far away, but it's so admirable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good word too. Thank you. And it is achievable though, when you think about all of those, that first talk that I gave Tuesday night, just about everybody that was here, we had a pretty big crowd, said basically the same thing when I was done. Huh? It was like, it really is. It's quite discursive as you get into it. But again, the Buddha's describing the state of mind that gets stuck in those kind of things. And the sutta speaks directly to that, but it concludes with basically, empty yourself of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's the basic teaching.
Very repetitive in a way. And you added each new layer to it as it went along, which helped you follow it. But it's, there were so many knot of the knot.
Yeah, it is.
And it's like, wow, now we're in triple negatives. And it seemed to me.
And I can't really call it a translation, but my adaptation of the translation from the Pali cut out about 70% of the repetition.
Yeah.
So try to follow that. Try to follow the exact Pali canon. And the reason where that repetition is there is that during the Buddha's time there was writing, but most people didn't trust writing for anything that was important. What was trusted was an oral tradition, and that oral tradition, probably the beginning of Buddhist chant, was to repeat things over and over and over again as a way of memorizing them and checking them for accuracy. So when it finally came time to write these down, they just used that common repetitiveness. So the Pali Canon is, you asked me before, the Pali Canon is full of a lot of repetition. It's very difficult to follow because of that. So that sutta was pretty tough to follow. I read in the Pali Canon. But you're right. It's true. More?
The repetition is also effective, not only in just maintaining the legitimacy of the continuity of it when it's written down, but it also is effective in conditioned mind. Like, you surrender. You're like, all right, I get it.
Yeah.
I have one. I know from your writings previously that you tend to change the words around a little bit for clarity's sake sometimes.
In so context, in, yeah.
Pardon?
In proper context.
Yeah. I think I have, I guess it's Bhikkhu Bodhi's middle-length discourses, and it's called the sutta, the teaching on voidness, and you use emptiness, use void, and I was just, not for tonight, but and maybe later, maybe I'll talk with you at some point. But that whole, I understand emptying of clinging and views and that whole, kind of kaleidoscopic and that's not it. But that whole discussion that we've had many times about where does the confusion on the interpretation of the teachings come from. And the word void, is, I think, is a troublesome word, and so many of the words in Pali didn't have, there is no accurate dukkha, there's no accurate English translation, and some of those early translations were the 50s and such, like when, I don't know, when a bunch of the English guys started translating the teachings, something like that.
Well, not to interrupt you, but it's a lot of the translations weren't from the, especially the ones that were in the early 1900s and early 2000s. Well, not 2000s, the late 1800s and early 1900s were from the Chinese Agamas and not directly from the Pali. So they were already heavily influenced away from what the Buddha actually taught. So it's important that you're that you bring up a good point that what translation you're looking at is important too. But I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no. Just, you know, as I said, it's just a remark right now. We can unpack the whole it later, but void, you know, that's like, I was like, ah, that's the name of the sutta in Bhikkhu Bodhi's Middle Age Discourses.
Yep.
The sutta, the teaching on the void or something. The big teaching, the little teaching. I don't know. Enough. I'm getting, I feel like my resonance that I work with. They were off the hook to me.
Maura works in the OT in a rehab nursing home.
Dementia care. Dementia care. They were off the hook.
Well, thank you for bringing it. That point is an important point about the translations that you read, depending on where they came from, are important. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is, I have a lot of respect for him, but he's a modern monk who insists on reconciling all the Buddhist practices into one, or at least trying to find a common ground. And what I've seen and what I've found is there's so much loss when you try to do that. It's not, you're not gaining anything. So, Robin, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you too. I'm good. Meditation's going a little better. I'm
great.
Starting to be able to do it more in the evening, not for very long, but trying to get the habit.
That's great. What benefits would you notice, if any? Especially from adding the second, you know, be more consistent with the second sit in the day.
Just knowing that I can discipline myself to do something that I don't really normally maybe want to do or understand the benefit in.
Yeah.
Just do it anyway.
That's so important. You know, that's an aspect of deconditioning your response that I can't do this or I don't want to do it, and you do it anyway. So good for you.
Also brings me back.
And it has no gain, no apparent gain,
right
now.
Yeah.
Like
just trusting that maybe someday I'll get it.
Yeah. Well, you will. Thank you. Glad you're here tonight, Alan. How are you tonight? Alan came to his first class tonight and last night in Clinton. So this is. Well, what did you think?
I fall into a group in which we only have 60% overlap in language.
So
you know. It feels good. That's the bottom line. I've now meditated 3 times.
Wow.
Okay.
Outstanding.
10 minutes yesterday with you. And then this morning, I read your book, the little one, the little yellow book.
Uh-huh.
And this morning, it said 2 or 3 minutes, and that seemed like way too little. So I set the timer for 5 minutes, and I was quite surprised how fast it went.
Wow,
I
good for you.
Really did. And yesterday, as well as today, I both felt my body relax and shift. Felt that. And I did have some, you know, thoughts entering there that I was able to get rid of them and move on.
Yeah.
Today, walking in late, lost, a little bit irritated, I had a hard time getting into it.
Yeah.
I didn't think I could do 20 minutes. It probably wasn't until just before you spoke the second time that I began to focus. I began to get rid of all the racing thoughts and all the stuff and all the irritation that I felt. And then my body began to relax. I felt that go through my body. And then I felt good for the second half of that. And again, I was surprised that I lasted 20 minutes. I was surprised at that.
Yeah, that's outstanding.
I sat 20 minutes without doing something, I think since McKinley was president. And he shot him, so.
Yeah. That's great. That's just wonderful, Alan. You're developing a meditation practice exactly as it should be. Some of those things that you talked about, like coming in here a little bit late and it took a while to settle down, that's common and something to learn from too. That you meditated 5 minutes right off the bat is also outstanding. And my instruction to start with short periods of meditation is the most reasonable way to begin a meditation practice that I found. But if you want to add more time, feel free to do so.
It was long enough, and since I was able to do 10 minutes last night, I said, why can't I do 5 today? And so I set the timer for 5 minutes, and I was quite surprised how quickly the time went and how quickly I got into what I would characterize as a relaxed body state.
Yeah.
It really felt good. It wasn't so much of a relaxed mind state, however. I mean, I still had thoughts banging around in there that had to do with things that were going on in my life, as opposed to just focusing on my breathing. But it was, I felt good after it was done. I really did. I felt good.
Good for you. Now, when you were caught up in those thoughts, and you found that you were caught, you acknowledged that you were caught up in the thoughts, you recognize it, you came back to your breathing.
I came back to, focus on your breathing, jerk.
That's leave the jerk out.
Okay.
I hope you continue to come to my classes, because you hear me say something very often. Be very gentle with yourself in your meditation practice. Don't judge yourself or the practice
that
harshly.
Routinely, so that is being gentle with myself with a sense of humor.
Good.
I really don't think I'm a jerk.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. And I think you're getting that. I said this quite often last night, maybe 5 or 6 times, that it's not just meditation, it's meditation as part of this broader framework. And that's what I'm talking about tonight, and that's what this talk was about. As you develop a little bit broader understanding of what the Buddha taught, emptiness will have even more importance to you, and maybe be even more clear what I talked about tonight. But it's an ongoing process, So this is the second of 3 talks this week. Saturday will be on the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta. It's another rather simple teaching on emptiness, where the Buddha relates emptiness to the 5 clinging aggregates, to this thing that this vehicle that we've created out of ignorance and call it a self. And he talks directly how to empty yourself of that specific type of ignorance. And we have a 1 or 5 hour retreat on Sunday here, and emptiness is the theme of it, although I won't be using either one of these suttas. And then our residential retreat in May, just a month away, the underlying theme is emptiness, but the whole retreat focuses on what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination, his very first 3 discourses, which are called the cardinal discourses, or the most important teachings he ever gave, and then we'll incorporate emptiness into that overall theme. And that's there info on the website about that. Any other questions about tonight's teaching or about our class? Well, and thank you for coming to our first Thursday night class,
Is Matt going to be leading some Qigong on Sunday?
Yes, Matt will be leading Qigong, interspersed with, the day will start with Matt leading a Qigong, a half hour, 45 minutes, then we'll meditate, and I'll give a morning Dhamma talk. Can't remember what it's on. And then we'll break for lunch, potluck lunch. Bonnie, who comes to our Tuesday class for the last couple of years, has developed I don't quite know what it is, but it has something to do with using these really intricate puppets that she's designed and created in a way that teaches mindfulness. And she's going to put on a little presentation of that as part of our retreat sometime in the very early afternoon. Then it'll be another talk, another meditation session. And we'll close with another Qigong session with Matt. So it's really a nice, wonderful day of taking refuge in our Sangha and in the Dhamma. So
the Bonnie puppets are
Laura's seen them. They're
unbelievable. Just seeing one of the Shidoshis, their plaster faces, but they're so exquisitely expressive, and they're unbelievable. I mean, just to see the face of one of them and their hands, the handiwork is unbelievable, but they're so evocative just looking at them. It's like that alone is worth just looking at them. But then to watch them move is just amazing.
Yes, I guess you have one person per puppet, if you want to call it a puppet.
Like the shot, one person might do one arm and a leg, and she does all this incredible beadwork, and they're just really amazing
life. Yeah, anyway. I'm looking forward to it. Okay, so we'll finish with metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And metta is both an expression of those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of a fully awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Excuse me. Wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.